It's the Wonky Show. We chat about the different cost of degrees, we talk about the TEF, and what UK students think about the finances of their universities. It's all coming up.
You don't just pay for your course, and I think it's broadening the understanding of where that money is being invested into the university. I think people underestimate students' ability to sort of take the truth, as it were, and I think if people were transparent about where money was being spent and how higher education is funded.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into higher education policy, people and politics. Rachel is away this week, so unfortunately you've got me, Jim Dickinson, but don't worry, because here to climb the hit parade of higher education policy, as usual, we have three awesome guests. In Cheltenham, we have Andy Yule, higher education data specialist. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm not sure how I feel about this, but it's my birthday in a couple of days' time, and it's quite a significant one.
And you're not going to say which one?
It's an important time when a man turns 30.
It's statistically significant. In Bath, we have Eve Alcock, President of the University of Bath Students Union. Eve, your highlight, please.
I went to the cinema this week to see On the Basis of Sex about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it was phenomenal.
Excellent. And in Wonky HQ this week, we have Wonky's editor, Debbie McVitie. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight is yet to come, because I'm looking forward to catching up with some old friends from my old job at the University of Bedfordshire. So that's going to be really fun.
Fabulous. Right, this week we kick off with a new report from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, or IFS, called Where is the Money Going? Estimating Government Spending on Different University Degrees. The report finds that the current system of funding undergraduate education is unevenly spread, with the cost to government highest for subjects where graduates earn the least and lowest for subjects where they earn the most. Debbie, can you elaborate for us?
So the origin of this question really was in the Office of National Statistics ruling before Christmas, that the government write-off for student loans should be reflected in government accounts not as an asset, but as an expenditure. So suddenly the cost of the system is coming under a great deal more scrutiny. So of course the next question is, well, where is the government spending most of its money, or, you know, the government, the taxpayer? And the answer, which kind of everyone knows, but the IFS has sort of set out in some detail, is that of course the government is spending money on the courses that have the lowest salary returns, because given that most courses cost the same, the subsidy will come where graduates don't necessarily earn enough after graduation to repay the bulk of their loan. And the issue, as it's framed in the report, is that the government kind of lacks control of public spending, because the system is driven by the choices of students, not all of whom, of course, will choose subjects that gain sufficient returns in government terms for government to be able to recoup the cost of their investment. There's some issues, of course, with this framing. One is that, of course, for students, I mean, the system is designed around student choice. That's really a feature of the system, not a bug. And it's hard to know what the alternative would be, because you end up saying things like, well, we have to constrain the numbers of students in degrees that don't necessarily pay sufficient salary returns. So you end up saying, well, only a small proportion of people can do creative arts, because we don't think you're going to earn enough in the future to pay sufficient amount of taxes for the whole system to be affordable, which becomes really, really problematic, because who do you say can do it and who do you say can't do it, and how do you stop universities from offering it, and so on and so forth. And of course, if you plan the system in that way, in a similar, more central way, there's really important questions about whether you actually end up with the right mix of skills in the economy to meet future skills needs. And that is a genuinely legitimate question. We can't necessarily predict in 20 years' time what the skills needs are going to be. And so student choice is quite an effective way, actually, of running a system. There's issues with the data, in the sense that all of this is based on salary returns of graduates in the last 10 years. So we're predicting what the salary returns might be in the future on the basis of data from the past. And of course, given the speed at which the economy changes and which labour market changes, it's really questionable about whether you can make meaningful policy predictions on the basis that everything will be the same as it was in the last 20 years. And if you look at megatrends like automation and digitisation and that sort of thing, it's not really kind of arguably reasonable to do that. And of course, the third issue is about university funding. And there's been a sort of flurry of reports in the area of cross-subsidy, which is a very wonkish thing, but is genuinely quite interesting. So HEPI estimated last year that on UK student teaching as a whole, so, you know, covering all the different subjects, universities just about break even on that. So what's actually happening is that courses for which it costs slightly less to teach there's a little bit of subsidies going into the courses that cost slightly more to teach. So if someone's studying philosophy, some of their fees probably going to top up the cost of someone else who's studying engineering. And that's fine because it's all equitable. Students are all paying the same. And of course, they're getting more than just the teaching. They're getting the whole wraparound student experience and all the academic support and the access to the library and all the rest of it. Universities break even on UK student teaching. They make a small surplus on international teaching. And that surplus has value because it can be put towards research, for which it's quite hard to recoup the full economic cost if you're a university. And it can also be put into investment in the future. So if you want to buy, if you want to make a big capital investment, build new buildings, invest in the student experience, then you need to be able to borrow money and you need to be able to kind of have a small surplus to be able to service that debt. So what there isn't really is any additional money floating about in universities to do things like pay for the privilege of teaching courses that have low salary returns, which is one of the recommendations the IFS brings. And what you would then create if you said, right, well, you have to kind of only bring in the amount, you can only borrow the amount of money that it costs to deliver the subject in order to protect taxpayers' money. You then create risks to the delivery of subjects. And often, in a lot of cases, the subjects that you most want to make sure are available in the economy.
Andy, I guess that, one of the things that lots of people have raised, Debbie mentioned it there, is this idea that, you know, the system is demand-led and that the aggregate choices of 18-year-olds are kind of driving things. But that's not actually strictly true, is it? Because some institutions have expanded where they are able to and where they've chosen to. And presumably lots of institutions have chosen to expand their cheaper-to-teach courses.
I think that's true. One of the upsides of the removal of student number control is that institutions arguably have a lot more freedom to develop and grow in areas that they think there is value in doing. I think one of the very interesting things about this report is that it in a sense it kind of sets out a very powerful argument for a return to a central grant allocation model, or if not that, certainly a very detailed and draconian centrally defined student number control. For many reasons in terms of the direction of other HE policy, I think that would be very much going against the flow. So there's a real tension here, isn't there, in policy. You know, the government wants to open up the market, give institutions more freedom, to grow and take off the control on student numbers. But the kind of downside on that is that, you therefore have to accept what the institutions are going to do. The other point about this, and something that I feel quite passionately about, is the idea that, you know, once again, this report really focuses the debate on the return of higher education in terms of a very simple measure of salary. And it doesn't, I think, do justice to the real value of higher education in its broadest sense, and the value of the arts and humanities to society, and what that does for us as a nation. We are world leaders in the creative arts, for God's sake. This continual focus on the only measure of HE success is how much you earn. I think it's actually a very sad path to go down.
Eve, obviously we've ended up with a system, and I guess these figures kind of lay it bare, where there's a bunch of students who are borrowing £9,250 where their course costs significantly more than that to teach, and a bunch of students who borrow exactly the same amount for whom their course costs significantly less to teach. Do you get a sense that students know the kind of big differences, and do you get a sense that if they did know, they'd be comfortable?
It's tricky, isn't it? One of our top 10 issues at Bath is increasing the knowledge for students around where their fees are being spent. I think we need to move away from higher education being this very sort of transactional, consumer-focused culture, though it is essentially you're paying X amount per year for your degree. But as Debbie alluded to, you don't just pay for your course. And I think it's broadening the understanding of where that money is being invested into the university. I think people underestimate students' ability to sort of take the truth, as it were. And I think if people were transparent about where money was being spent and how higher education is funded, I only see it as a positive thing, because I think students would understand, basically.
Yes, I think one of the things. There was quite an interesting report last week from the Financial Sustainability Strategy Group. And one of the things it called for was a mature conversation among students and staff and universities about where the money goes and how universities are funded. And of course, there was some HEPI pulling out today that said that students would kind of would like to know a bit more about where the money is coming from and what their universities are spending on, and also whether their universities are in financial difficulty. So I suppose there's a kind of space here for us to say, let's trust each other to have mature conversations about how we're kind of funding our university system and what's sort of being got for that isn't just about, well, I pay this in and I take this out. Because, of course, student fees go towards all kinds of things, including supporting access for other students. And, you know, I have a degree of confidence that a lot of students would say, well, that's exactly how it should be. If I make money in the future, then my paying back goes to help other people who now have the same opportunities that I do. And that's exactly how it should be.
Good. Let's see who's been blogging for us then this week.
Stevenson, Head of Student Support at the University of Stirling, and I'm leading the delivery of a holistic strategy to prevent and tackle gender-based violence. Developed in partnership with our students' union and a range of local and national partners, it aims to create a culture where gender-based and sexual violence are not tolerated. Staff and students feel comfortable to report gender-based violence, and our community is confident in how to support anyone who's been affected. We have created an interactive staff training programme, a new network of 16 trained sexual violence and misconduct liaison officers, a comprehensive website, and a multiple award-winning campaign, Is This OK?, which aims to challenge inappropriate behaviours relating to sexual and gender-based violence. So far, we've trained over 400 staff, and the training has evaluated extremely well. The SVMLOs have already supported students who have reported sexual violence, and we see an increase in reports as an indicator of success and culture change, as we know sexual and gender-based violence are severely underreported across society, not just in universities.
Hi, I'm Neil McKenzie. I'm the Head of Advice and Representation at Sheffield Students' Union. I've written a piece for Wonky this week, discussing my views on resilience in the context of higher education. Our students are so often criticised for lacking it. Universities and schools are encouraged to ensure that students have it, but resilience is a concept that I've always found quite problematic. I think the concept is blind to privilege, structural inequality, and it's based on a really deeply individualistic view of the world. I think we can consider how we can create resilient communities on our campuses, benefit our students collectively, and maybe, just maybe, provide them with the resilience to face the uncertainties of our future and come up with some different solutions.
I am Anthony Selden from the University of Buckingham, and I believe that mindfulness has a really important role to play in helping our universities, our staff and our students. So, very quickly, a definition from John Kabat-Zinn, who is the leader of mindfulness at the medical school at the University of Massachusetts. And he says, mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. I think that the evidence points to five possible benefits of mindfulness. Firstly, on mental health of students and staff, that mindfulness is the very grounding of what it means to be healthy mentally, with an ability to be able to choose to not react, to be calm and in control, to sleep well, and to live a life in accordance with one's values.
Now, next up, the Teaching Excellence and Student Outcomes Framework, or TEF, as it is. It says here, fondly known. I don't know what Rachel was thinking when she was writing this. The 1st of March was the deadline for submission to the independent review of the TEF, led by Dame Shirley Pearce. And following on from this, we've seen this week a number of interesting comments and interventions as people have sought to publicise their own response. Andy, tell us more.
So, if you're listening to this podcast, you know what the TEF is, and you will know a lot of the background to it. because you
unless
do.
You've tumbled onto this by accident.
That's right. So obviously, you know, the review was the deal, the compromise in the 2017 Act about the linking of TEF to student fees, and we shouldn't, I think, forget the significance of what might come out of this review in terms of future funding arrangements. So yes, it's been a very interesting few days in terms of the TEF. We've had the UUK submission. The Russell Group, I think, were perhaps a little more forthright than the UUK. They explicitly called for the subject TEF element to be stopped. I think the UUK submission was a little bit more on the fence about that. For me, the big news about this, I mean, perhaps not surprisingly given my background, but for me, the really big news this week has been the response of the Royal Statistical Society. If you've been following the TEF story closely, you will know that the Royal Statistical Society has been fairly critical of some of the technical elements, the statistical elements of the TEF, and has consistently raised some fairly significant concerns about the validity of the statistical work that is being undertaken. They have published responses to previous consultations where they have said some fairly difficult politically things, but also actually some sort of big sums and numbers and fairly difficult things in that respect. What they have done this week, I think, is in some ways a bit of a game changer. They have made a response to the 1st of March deadline to the Pearce review, and they have published that. They have reiterated many of their concerns, but what they have also done this week is they have called for the Director General of the UK Statistics Authority, the regulator of official statistics, to take a view on the validity of the statistics in the TEF or not. And I think there's a sense in which they've kind of pressed the nuclear button now with this, because, you know, the Royal Statistical Society, these are not a fly-by-night bunch of people. They are statisticians. They are indeed royal statisticians. And so they are not going to say something and do something like this without giving it very careful consideration. The OFS last year signed up to the National Statistics Code of Practice, something that the predecessor organisation HEFSI never did. And I think it's right the OFS did sign up to that code of practice, given the prominence of data and statistics in the whole regulatory framework. So the OFS have submitted themselves to the domain of the regulator of UK statistics.
Andy, there's a bit of a hostage to fortune situation here, but can you give us a sense of some of the things they're actually critiquing? So is it the way the data's collected or the behaviours it generates? I mean, what's their beef?
So they have a number of beefs. Some of them, as somebody who is not a trained statistician, I struggle to understand myself. The key issues are, firstly, the idea that the statistics that they are measuring are not a reliable indicator of quality. And that is a debate that has been prominent throughout this, the whole TEF exercise. There are issues about the extent to which the way it has been set up, it is open to gaming. I think there is an issue there. The more technical issues are around sample sizes and the extent to which with larger sample sizes, larger amounts of data for larger institutions, you are more likely to get false results, false positive results in some of the indicators. I would suggest Googling a few scholarly articles on some of this. They are all valid statistical points. And I guess for me, the key thing is it's actually not what is being said, but it's who's saying it.
Debbie, the thing about this is, so sure, TEF uses proxies, and sure, it's open to gaming, but isn't that just what happens when you use metrics in education? So isn't there a danger here? I'm not saying this is a miserable danger from everyone's point of view, but isn't there a danger here that actually what they're doing isn't really critiquing TEF? They're kind of critiquing almost the entirety of Michael Barber's career.
I think it comes back to putting limits on what you can reasonably say using data. So the intention of the TEF was originally, back in the day when it was a twinkle in Joe Johnson's eye, was to enable effective differentiation between institutions in order to inform student choice. You know, it is one thing to say, you know, X institution has this kind of retention statistic and another institution has a different one. And to say, and obviously there's context that we should take into account in kind of understanding why that's going on, as Hisa has done for years, and saying, ah, well, and this is now contributing towards a judgment which we expect to inform, which we expect, you know, on which we expect students to base the choices that were going to affect their lives for, you know, for many years to come. And this is where I think, you know, I think the TEF has basically sort of overreached itself in its aspirations. There's also, I think, a question about what's left when you strip out some of that stuff. So I think one of the things we know is that at the minute, students actually aren't using the TEF to drive choice. They're, you know, of the students that are aware of it, it's because the institutions that they're interested in have been banging on about their amazing TEF scores. So it's not that students are kind of making finely grained decisions based on TEF at the minute. But there's also the question about, If we stripped out some of this some of the kind of idea about comparability and benchmarking, you would be left with absolute scores, which would be, I think, very unfair, because you really just can't compare one sort of institution that's doing one sort of thing and serving one sort of student with another that's kind of trying to do something rather different, and that's fundamentally it would no longer be appropriate. So you've got a problem there, you know, if it's not supporting student choice. But the kind of the thing that I think the sector is quite interested in and would like to kind of carry on the conversation about is how do you raise the standard and profile and value of teaching in universities? And I think, I mean, the conclusion that we seem to be a little bit of ahead of steam seems to be building up behind is that a big kind of enormous exercise to benchmark student outcomes and try and, you know, it create comparability and that, you know, that the TEF has become the sort of monster isn't really the best way to do that. But what would be sad would be if we sort of said, well, the TEF isn't working, but let's stop talking about teaching, because it is really important. It's what students care about, and it's doing really important stuff.
Eve, can I ask you a question? So you can probably imagine, well, no, you can probably think of a little bit of Bath somewhere whose outcomes are terrible, and they're not justified by that's just the sort of subject it is, or do you know what I mean? So last summer the NSS results will have come out, and you'll have spotted a couple of pockets of really poor either assessment and feedback or teaching. In those moments, presumably you're thinking, do you know what these proxies will do, because we can then go and sort of, you know, push some buttons and try and get some improvement.
Yeah, I think there is an element of that. But I suppose when I saw this story, a massive part of me, so one of the issues being that the idea that the stats that are measured aren't reliable indicators of quality, my initial reaction was, we've always been saying this. Students and students' unions around the country have always been saying this, because it's based on the assumption that teaching quality is measured by how well you do or how soon you're in employment. So, for example, at Bath, that doesn't make any sense, because 60% of our students do placement years, and a lot of their first graduate jobs, they actually get offered whilst they're on their placement year. It's no indication of teaching. And with students, I think it's always so subjective. The way that one particular lecturer on a particular course teaches might work brilliantly for a selection of students, but it's not going to work for absolutely everyone. It completely ignores the diversity within the student body. And, you know, what would it look like? And I'm not suggesting this is a good idea, but what would it look like if actually teaching quality took into account a student's ability to think for themselves and critique ideas and have confidence and, you know, self-belief and that kind of teaching quality, as opposed to just whether or not they're in employment however long after university.
I think you're wrong, Eve. I think that's an excellent idea.
Well, it's dangerous though, isn't it? Because I suppose we've got, is it the LEO survey that's putting in subjective well-being questions? Like, how happy are our graduates?
Oh, the Delhi, yeah. Destination of Believers.
Yeah,
I mean, yes, you are, but I think it's really interesting I suppose the question there is to what extent is subjective well-being attributable to your higher education qualification, you know?
Exactly. So that's an issue.
Yeah,
so.
But I mean, I think it is a genuine effort to try and kind of present a more rounded picture of graduate outcomes, because of course one of the things that higher education does is it gives you more choices in your life. It gives you more power to control your life, and the kind of the alignment of that with your well-being, I think, is a quite important thing to draw out. But I mean, yeah, it's experimental and it's new and it's going to be misrepresented, which of course is the other big data story in higher education is that these things get picked up and kind of run with and not contextualized and not thought about.
Andy, there's another question here, I think, that I'm going to put for you. Over in further education, there will be a bunch of apprenticeships that are inspected by Ofsted with all of the things that we understand that to mean. And then there are some degree level apprenticeships that where the kind of quality regime is very, very different and includes things like, you know, TEF and subject TEF. Do you think that can survive that kind of, you know, that fundamentally different approach in what Auger may be trying to craft to be a kind of single tertiary system?
So I think what you're therefore asking is a broader and actually quite different question, isn't it? Because it's absolutely right to ask it, because the history of the TEF largely comes out of a conversation about quality assurance in higher education and a pushback against what was seen as a very intrusive quality assurance process. And therefore, the government decided to let the data provide the answer. And so, you know, you absolutely get into the more philosophical questions about, you know, is data a good indicator for quality? Can it be a good indicator for quality? HE has taken this route. FE is still in the space of having regular Ofsted inspections. I wonder if there is a sense of the pendulum swinging about this. With Auger yet to report, whenever that is going to report, there is a sense in which we kind of have to just accept that all bets are off now.
Terrific. And look, lots of people won't have seen this, but I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Anthony McLaren, who of course used to run the Quality Assurance Agency, who now runs TEXA over in Australia, has written recently on the kind of history of the UK quality wars and some of the kind of background and context. So if you want to have a look at that, take a look at the show notes on wonky.com. Now, next up. Every week this season, as you know, we delve deep into the sector's past to uncover stories of how things were and how things came to be with Nottingham Trent's academic registrar, Mike Ratcliffe. Here's part 9 of the hidden history of HE.
So Oxford and Cambridge have now got these colleges nearby which are educating people in the same curriculum, but they are not members of the university. So they've got this kind of beginning of a mingling, because Oxford and Cambridge is full of independent colleges, so you could put a women's college in either of those two cities, and it can educate people to the same thing. They can go, eventually they're allowed access to the same lectures, but they have to work out what to do. So the Cambridge solution, which comes after a lot of agitation from progressive academic staff to say, well, we should have women as members of the university, but a lot of reaction from you have to call the reactionary clergy, who are all members of the university and have the right to vote on any university statute, who can come back by train to vote down any clauses that might look like that women might be allowed in. And there's a big celebration when they vote down the clause that women should be admitted to the university. They have there's a great picture of it, of a huge throng outside King's College, and men celebrating the fact that they've kept women out of the university. They have an effigy of a woman on a bike. She's wearing bloomers because they're worried that women are going to be riding around Cambridge in their bloomers. The whole place is going to change. And they get so excitable that they go out to one of the women's colleges and rattle the gates so violently that women are scared inside that the violence is going to be done to them. So they get very overexcited. So what they end up with is this wonderful, if you're part of this internal thing, compromise, whereby the women can take the exams, continue to take the exams, and they can be admitted as students, but they can't become members of the university by getting the degree. So they get to know how well they did in the exam, but they don't get the BA or MA degree, and they're not allowed to do that. Now, unfortunately, because Cambridge has this big reaction against it, they don't try during the interwar years to overturn it, or that it gets put back. So it's only in 1948 that the University of Cambridge admits its first woman graduate, who is an honorary graduate. Queen Elizabeth is admitted as the first woman graduate of the University of Cambridge. So a huge amount of tussle about this. So Cambridge has a very strict list system in terms of its thing. So women knew that they were best in their year at the subject, but didn't get the degree. So obviously, things are much, much better now. Everything is solved. There's no problems at all, and that's all fine. There's obviously a series of gradations about Oxford colleges becoming mixed, about the ability of women to become academic staff. So we're better and better and better. But if you think how many, we're dealing with a generation that was alive in 1948. This is a generation that women could not graduate at one of our universities until after that point.
Now, next up, the Higher Education Policy Institute, or HEPI as it's more widely known, has conducted research with over 1,000 full-time undergrads to find out what UK students think about the financial health of their university. Eve, tell us more.
So, for brief context, the OFS have made it abundantly clear that they're not going to be like HEFI when it comes to helping institutions on the verge of bankruptcy. So, we've seen stories of lots of universities, well, not lots, but a few universities in trouble, but lots of stories about that in the news. And most recently, that I think it was the University of Surrey have opened an all-staff voluntary redundancy scheme due to the need to make, I think it's about £15 million of savings. So it's a hot topic, but this report outlines student views on it. So the report overall suggests that the general trend is students are sort of optimistically ignorant, should we say, of the financial stability of their own institutions, and that their views appear to directly contradict current policy on the topic. So some headline statistics, 83% of the students polled said that they're confident in their institution's financial position. So from this, I wondered how students could be confident at all with the level of information that universities put out about their finances. And the stuff that does get put out is, you know, in financial statements and things, it's quite impenetrable and it's difficult to really tell from them. And from what the financial statements say, I'd say as a sabbatical officer, we see slightly different viewpoint because we go into meetings and we're asking for funding on something or we sit on finance committee and things aren't as sort of shiny as perhaps the like nicely bound financial statements might always suggest. 97% of students, so nearly everybody asked, would want to know if their university was in financial trouble, which puts, I suppose, that's against what the OFS would probably suggest because you don't want to name and shame universities because it makes recruitment worse. And particularly as I think it was 84% of students said they'd be less likely to apply to their uni if they knew it was a financial trouble anyway. So there's a big discrepancy there. 71% of the students believe that the government should step in if a university was in financial trouble. And again, that's what goes against what we're hearing from the OFS about their approach. So I suppose the question becomes, what should institutions do with this data, do about these findings? Student protection plans are the device that should be protecting students in the event of either institutional collapse or indeed course closure. So making sure that those are robust and sort of up to date is imperative. But 89% of the respondents don't know what student protection plans are. And even more, 93% haven't seen their university's one. So I decided to go on Bath's website and look up our student protection plan. And it is on the website, so already better than some other universities. But it does say we will publicise the student protection plan in partnership with the Students' Union. And in partnership with the SU, we will brief your academic reps on the key elements of it and ask them to cascade this information to the rest of your cohort.
And is that the first you've heard of it?
Yes. It also says that the student protection plan should go through one of our subcommittees of Council and Senate. So we've got one called Council Senate Students Union. Apparently, it gets renewed there every year. And I asked some of our SU staff this morning, and I don't think that's happened at all in recent years. It often sort of gets rushed over to us, and we sort of cast an eye over it. But it's always quite late on in the game, and there's no real partnership or consultation on it. So, yeah. That's the situation.
Debbie, I guess the student protection plan thing is really important if it's the case that we think some institutions are going to go under or are really close. Mm. But I'm not sure we do know, do we?
Well, the flimsiness of student protection plans is pretty well understood. And the kind of, I guess, you know, the kind of fiction that universities would be able to kind of organise a seamless transfer for their students to IN other institution that would be of equal kind of value to the student. Continues to be the basis on which we kind of make these claims. But I do think that there is we are not interrogating the notion of financial trouble sufficiently. So I think this idea that, you know, oh, well, we know an institution's in financial trouble and because it's got massive loans, it's servicing a lot of debt, or because it's got a voluntary redundancy scheme open, or, because the rumour is that they're not doing so well, is often not really sufficient to say that an institution is in financial trouble. Because, for example, I mean, having lots of debt is fine if you have the ability to service it and you're confident about future income. Having a VR scheme on the go could mean, and while that's really challenging for the universities that are going through that process, it could mean that the university is taking steps to differentiate itself and offer different courses and offer things in a different way. That will mean it will be financially secure for the future. And actually, universities, I think, that are in financial trouble are the ones that are where you're not sort of seeing enormous VR schemes. You're not seeing kind of big headlines about debt. You're seeing little things chipping away, little services just kind of being quietly retired, things being moved back. And what you've got there is a university that's desperately trying to kind of balance its books year on year with a kind of gently declining student number and no kind of obvious strategy for changing that. And those are the ones that aren't going to be making the headlines.
Andy, do you think it is true that if a university said, look, we are in financial trouble, that would cause the sort of run on the bank, collapsing applications that is invoked as the reason why some of the interventions from OFS are kept confidential?
My gut feeling is it probably is. I don't think there's any sort of hard research anyone can quote on this, but with the higher education proposition now pitched so much as a financial investment in young people's future, you know, you're not going to make that huge investment with an organisation that you think is in danger of some kind of financial calamity. So although there's no hard evidence to back this up, my gut feeling very strongly is that it would. And I think that is the general consensus view. That's certainly the way it has always been approached. One does not make public some of the things that go on in the background. I mean, HEFC used to do an awful lot in the background under the radar to help and support institutions as they navigated through their difficulties. And actually, just picking up on one of the points that Debbie made, you know, the idea that, you know, the existence of a voluntary redundancy scheme could in some cases be seen as a very positive thing because it is an organization that is taking positive, yes, very difficult, but very positive action to address its problems.
I found it interesting that the HEPI report, the sample is just over 1,000 full-time undergraduate students. And there's quite a lot of majority statistics in it that make it look like this is a really overwhelming, decisive view of students. But to have quite a homogenous group of full-time undergraduates was interesting to me because full-time undergraduates are going to be largely at university, maybe 3 years average, which you might take the financial position of your institution into account more if you know you're going to be there for a considerable amount of time. Whereas if you look at PGTs, certainly at Bath, the PGT market is where they're wanting to sort of expand. Perhaps being there for a year, you might presume that perhaps actually that financial stability of the institution won't affect you so much because it's just 12 months, you're in, you're out, and you're gone. And I'd be interested to see the breakdown with international and home students as well.
Now it's quiz time. Here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor, David Kerner.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment that's consistently more statistically reliable than the Office for Students' use of the concept of explained gaps. This week has given me another excuse to dive back into the amazing HESA staff dataset, and I've plotted the percentage of 2016-17 academic staff that left an institution against the percentage of 2017-18 staff that joined an institution. You'd think there'd be a slow growth in staff numbers all round, right? Yes, but does it correlate?
So look, there's always going to be churn in the sector, and you know we've spoken already about the idea that, you know, universities will continually be looking at their offering, moving out of subject areas, moving into new subject areas. So you know that this I guess at a sector level at least is very much the ebb and flow and the evolution of AG. I think it is probably a much more interesting question to look at it at the individual institutional level.
Yes, Andy, but do the two correlate?
Yes, I think they probably do.
Yeah, I think they probably do as well. But I thought the same thing. I thought it would be interesting to see whether there was the causation in there. But that's just me, GCSE science, drilled into my brain. Just because there's correlation doesn't mean there's cause.
No. R squared is 0.13, meaning we can wave a fond farewell to any idea of a sector-wide trend. The graph, as always, is on the show pages on the site. It's well worth a look. I've removed one anomaly where the data appears to be incorrect. As always, this is just the institutions included in the HESA dataset. Where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it. See you next time.
And finally, a survey of almost 40,000 students from 140 universities conducted by the Insight Network, and they put a box of stuff in your halls for Dig In, shows a rise in students with mental illness, with one-fifth of students being diagnosed with a mental illness in 2018. Debbie, can you share a bit more of the survey?
This is an enormous survey, and it's amazing that we've not been able to kind of muster the resources kind of within the sector to run something like this. But the findings are that about a fifth of students have a current mental health diagnosis, which means that they have been formally diagnosed by a medical professional with a mental health issue, predominantly anxiety or depression disorders, but of course, you know, could be the full gamut of mental health issues. A third have experienced a serious psychological issue for which they felt they needed professional help. So that could be a sort of intermittent periods of poor mental health, which each of these issues can of course affect anybody in the population. The challenge here is the sheer scale, I think, is quite. And of course, when mental health practitioners who work in universities, you know, may not be surprised by these findings, but the sheer numbers of students kind of coping with mental health challenges. It's quite sort of surprising, I guess.
Eve, one of the things that happened yesterday afternoon is a press release came in from DfE announcing a student mental health task force that Chris Skidmore was convening that is focused fairly tightly on transitions to university and so on and so on. Is that the answer?
I don't think it's the answer. I think it's probably a welcome development, especially somewhere like Bath, where entrance grades can be very, very high. What you see is a lot of students feel they've gone from their sixth form college, where they've gone from being sort of big fish, small pond, very, very good academically, and then they come to university where suddenly everybody is very, very good academically, and you feel really average. And there's a real issue, I think, and I'm sure it's not exclusive to Bath, with perfectionism and not feeling comfortable with failure. But I think with mental health, there's two things here. There's the reactive side of what universities need to be doing to support people who are already suffering or already at crisis point. And that is, you know, comes back to what I hear from students about counselling wait times and the fact that you only get 6 weeks of counselling and then you're sort of left on your own again. And then there's the proactive stuff, which is how are we creating an environment at university that facilitates positive mental health and well-being that is protective of getting to that crisis point. And unfortunately, no matter how much universities are trying to do the proactive and, you know, let's have a mental health strategy, let's think long-term about this, let's create a good environment, that's brilliant. But the students that care deeply about this are often the ones that are either at crisis point themselves or are supporting students who are at that point. And you need to do the proactive and the reactive in tandem for students to start feeling like their institutions are taking this seriously.
Good, so that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you can find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, as Andy and Eve have done so expertly, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Andy and to Eve, and of course to Debbie, everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay healthy.